October 5th, 2008, lecture discussion number 61 on Genesis 1 through 19. Last week, having promised to address the three-year-old female goat of Genesis 15, right here, and I'm going to address that goat today by going through Leviticus 16, where there's two goats sacrificed. And this, of course, is the feast day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur, where those two goats are sacrificed, which, by the way, is what? October 9th this year. And let me just point out, what, by the way, are the chances that I would be dealing with goat sacrifices and Yom Kippur with respect to Genesis 15, lecture number 61, within the very week that Yom Kippur falls? Hold your applause. I know it's imagine a Yom Kippur goat killing sermon right around Yom Kippur. I mean, what are the chances? It couldn't happen. And I do so like to do goat sacrificing on Mother's Day, and I ended up right on Yom Kippur, Christmas Eve at least, but here we are. And I know you're thinking it's incredible careful planning and forethought. But there's no way. There's no way. 61 sermons and I hit within 4 days of Yom Kippur. That's just brilliant. Okay, it's blind, dumb luck. But nonetheless, we're at Leviticus 16 and it's 4 days away from when this ceremony would have occurred. It doesn't occur today. We don't kill goats and bulls today. How come? Boy, oh boy, we got to get your church attendance up. We're not doing it today because, or the Jews don't do it today because there is no temple. And if there were a temple, they would be doing it on October 9th. I believe October 9th is when it is this day. We're right now 4 days away from the actual day, and we are within the 10 days of penitence, or the days of awe, or the awesome days. And that's the 10 days of their preparation for the high priest that occurs in those days. And the Jewish people don't have a high priest right now. And why don't they have a high priest? Because they can't clean him. What do they need to clean him with? Ashes of the red heifer. So if all of those things start to come into play, you'll see the Jewish priesthood come back into the forefront. They didn't have a Jewish priesthood for the longest time for a whole bunch of reasons besides not having the temple. One, they were dispersed. Two, the Hebrew language began to die out. The nation of Israel caused the Hebrew language to come back into place. When's the Jewish New Year? You know, they shut down the Congress because of the Jewish New Year. What day was that? That's Rosh Hashanah, by the way. What day? That was the 30th of September. That's a significant day, by the way, because on the 30th of September, or Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, especially this year, but almost on every Jewish New Year, what gets predicted? No, it always is the rapture. Every trumpet, you know, is the rapture day. And once again, those predicting the rapture would occur on the feast day of trumpets were wrong. Looking at the congregation today, though, we should be worried. There's a possibility that we didn't get, never mind. But we could be in big trouble. Those books come out every year. They came out again this year. Someone brought me one and said, hey, look, rapture's going to be on September 30th. Pay $25. There is never anyone who goes broke who bets on the gullibility of the Christian church. They don't. Humanity, for that matter, but the Christian church is my particular area, so I wish for the Christians to be wise and not suckers. And that's, by the way, something I'll be doing as the weeks come along. As soon as I get out of Genesis, I'm going to start doing subjects that at least add in little things. As you know, I love these little magic show things. I love to watch them, and I'm always fascinated by people who are fooled by them. Because that stuff has gotten into the church. And I'm going to add into the regular topics a little bit of vignette, if you will, things like the most common con games and scams that plague the church today. And you have all seen them. I know you have. You go to any of these churches, especially the larger ones, these scams and con games are in everyone, even small ones. They've infiltrated. Why does the church use them? They work. I got a letter the other day telling me to send my dividend check. I can't wait to read that to you. Did I do it? No. Did someone do it? Yes. Okay. Not just 10% of my dividend check, the whole dividend check. Okay. So I'll be bringing that in. I won't identify them because it's embarrassing, but it's very important that the church understand this kind of thing. And I, as I said, these books keep coming around on these feast days. There's no end to them, and certainly no end to those who are fooled by them. The motive is always the same, as John said. It's money. It's happening today. It's going to happen today in Anchorage. And the people who should be wise, those of us who are students of Scripture, that care about Scripture, we should not be taken by them. We should try. We actually stand up and try to stop them. I get invited all the time to the traveling evangelist shows. I don't know why they invite me, but when they do come in, they call me up and ask me, first and foremost, they want to know if I want to sing in the choir. They clearly don't know me. But then they ask me if I want to sit on stage. Sun Yat Moon's group always asks me if I'd like to be on stage. Why do they want me on stage, for that matter? Yes, exactly right. They want as many pastors as they possibly can get that are considered conservative evangelicals to sit on stage at these big, because it brings credibility to them. And it is exactly that approval. Exactly what they want. And by the way, once you know the trick, all the tricks, you won't be welcome anymore. They don't want you to the magic show or the hypnotist show, the traveling evangelist show or whatever. They don't appreciate it when you yell out the solutions to the tricks. And they won't invite you back. So I'm sorry. That'll end your... No, I'm not really sorry, am I? But ruining things is, I believe, a great gift. And one of the highest compliments you can pay me is when you say to me, I now no longer can sing this song because I know it's doctrinally unsound. And it was my favorite song. And I say, I'm sorry. But that's not true. That's a fake sorry. I'm not really sorry. I pretend only to be sorry. But I am glad that you are now paying attention to the doctrinal analysis of everything that you sing or say or witness. What's sad to me is how easily we're duped. And when I say we, I mean the church as a general. How simple the techniques are that make people just marvel and amazed, especially children. When I say children, I mean who? People under the age of 55. Okay, maybe 20. But it's really focused on the youth because they are the most emotional and the easiest. Look, advertising is focused on the youth too. How come? Everybody wants the 18 to 30 demographic. Why? Because you are the most willing to take your money out and spend it. And that is what the plan is. It's all carefully thought through. Like I said, I love to watch the stage magicians. There's this guy that's on TV and he's a mask. He's got a mask on and they explain all these little tricks that they do. And when you see how elementary the amazing stunt is, you wonder, how is it that I was fooled by it? You know, the rope, the one I really liked, Lori and I were watching it. He could make a toothpick disappear out of his hands, hold it in his hand. And then, boom, it disappears. It's very, very well done. He does it with a piece of tape. Hey. And they make a comment. Whenever you see the lovely girls pushing the stairway around, the magician is always hiding in the stairway. It's simple. It's where he is. Whenever you see curtains and lights, the guy isn't there. It's a body double. The tricks are so simple and so elementary, it's just sad that we're fooled by them. Same thing happens in the church. You wonder how you were deceived by something so simple. And so I'm going to be dealing with that. I'm going to reveal those tricks, the typical church routines that are mostly on television, but still happen locally. And they're practiced. You need to know. They're not spontaneous. I really appreciate the churches that have four, and I get in trouble for saying things like this, but the people who get mad at me aren't here today, so piece of cake. Oh, okay. But I appreciate the services that go at 9 and 10:30 and 12:30 and 1 o'clock. I appreciate those because they repeat them each and every time. And so you can watch all of them happen one after another at the same time. All you have to do is sit through all the services. Then I want you to be skeptical. I want you to be wise. So I'll be going over those. And that's the purpose, is to get you wise, someone that is not fooled, someone that is suspicious, someone that cares about the truth, someone that isn't manipulated. Okay, before we get to our text this morning, Leviticus 16, I want to make a couple of quick points about Genesis 15. That's very funny. There might be one in here that I'm still offending. That's, comedy is hard. But I want to make a couple of quick points about Genesis 15. It's important to note the flaming torch and the smoking furnace. Those are very important. Is it on the board anymore? No, it's gone. But the smoking furnace and the flaming torch are going through. They're passing through these animals that have been cut in half. Now, whether or not they've been cut in half and made two equal halves, as some would think, or they have been beheaded, as others would think, the flaming torch and the smoking furnace pass through those parted animals while Abraham is asleep off the side. And a covenant and an agreement, a solution occurs through the act of that happening. And the agreement, the solution, and the covenant, as I just said, with Abraham asleep, is God alone. God is doing it by himself. No one else is involved. When he cut those things in half, or had Abraham cut them in half, he passed through them himself in this form, if you will, portraying him is this smoking furnace and flaming torch. So we have to figure out, what does the furnace represent? What does the torch represent? But one thing we know is that the agreement, the solution, the covenant is God all by himself. No one else involved. It's his promise. It's his doing. He's the one passing. It's his act. It's his plan. And I can't emphasize that enough. He alone passes through the pieces and the birds. But there are two aspects of him. Smoking furnace, flaming torch. Now, knowing that the pieces and the birds are primarily, foremost, representative of who? They're representative of Christ, the person and the work of Christ. God the Son, the second person of the triune Godhead, the angel of the Lord, Yeshua, salvation, primarily, foremost, they are representative of Jesus Christ, and those are all names of him that I just rattled off. So, the obvious question, if they represent Christ, all these pieces, and they represent part of his person or all of his person or his work, and these two, the furnace and the torch, are passing through, specifically, what aspects of Christ are these things representing? What agreement is necessary? What is God agreeing to do? And as most of you are aware, I think that the New Testament complement to Genesis 15, I think this is your math equation again today. Genesis 15 equals Matthew 26:36 to the conclusion of the chapter. 55. I should remember that. That is your formula. Genesis 15 equals Matthew 26:36 through 55. And of course, it also equals the corresponding passages in Luke, Mark, and John. What is Matthew 26:36 through 55? It's Gethsemane. It is where Christ is dealing with not my will be done, but your will be done. I'm saying to you that Genesis 15 equals Gethsemane. They are the same thing. The passing through the animals with the smoking furnace and the flaming torch is absolutely the same as Christ in Gethsemane weeping and talking about this cup. Same thing. Solve this one. Solve that one. Have trouble with Gethsemane? Solve Genesis 15. You're home free. They should be side by side. The events of the Garden of Gethsemane should be read side by side with Genesis 15, especially the cup. If you don't understand what's in the cup, if it bothers you, you can't figure out why it is that Christ seems to be in conflict there, then what mistake have you made? You're wrong, because Christ can't be in conflict. The Son cannot be in conflict with the Father. So the will of the Son and the will of the Father are what? The same. So how could he possibly say, not my will? Let this cup pass. The solution to all of that is in Genesis 15. And by the way, if you haven't been here for that, it's called a dramatic theodicy. Dramatic theodicy. That's what Gethsemane is. And I don't have time to go over that again today. If you have any questions and haven't heard that, come up and see it. Now, having said that, most of you are aware that I'm convinced that the flaming torch and the smoking furnace represent what? By the way, the torch is the Shekinah glory. I think that these two going through those pieces, these two represent what? What does the furnace represent? Have you heard me do this before? Yes, you have. You must yell out answers. It makes me enthusiastic. The Spirit? No, it's two aspects of God. Yes, it is the love of God or the mercy of God and the holiness or the justice or the judgment. I'll put it down this way, the judgment of God. What's passing through, what's in agreement, what is coming to a solution, what is coming to agreement, what is coming to a covenant, what is coming to, if you wish, peace. That's a bad way of putting it because there's always peace in God, but I'm just trying to humanize it for you. What is the conflict that is happening is between love and judgment, and it is coming to agreement here. If you would wish to use that kind of terminology, though theologically unsound, it is coming to agreement, covenant, through those pieces. It's also happening again in Gethsemane in the same way. It's a dramatic theodicy. What God is teaching Abraham, Christ is teaching his disciples. Same lesson, different way. Not really that different. Genesis 15 is teaching Abraham that the love of God and the judgment of God are what? Equal. They're equal. Now that's, by the way, not very popular today. That's not a popular concept within our era of church, what we would call the modern era or the contemporary era. In fact, that concept has been outright discarded and declared untrue. But the Bible says no. God is love. God is holiness. God is judge. God is merciful. God is long-suffering. God is wrath. Both are true. Both are equal. And that's very dismaying today. In fact, I will tell you that you hardly hear it. Let me quote the typical position. I copied this down word for word because it is very, very common today. So I wanted to get it right. This is what a theologian said today, or this last couple of weeks, actually. I got it in a periodical. This is what he just said. So this is how fresh it is. It is beyond, so I'm quoting him, not me. It is beyond a reasonable doubt that Jesus, Paul, and other Bible writers, traditional Christian theologians, and traditional Christians hold to the belief that punishment for the unforgiven sinner is severe and eternal in hell. Now, let me repeat what he's trying to say. He says, it is beyond a reasonable doubt that Jesus, Paul, and the old Christian writers, and the traditional Christians today, and traditional Christian theologians, all those people, it is beyond reasonable doubt that they believe that punishment for the unforgiven sinner is severe and eternal in a place called hell. Note, by the way, that Jesus is stripped of his godhood in that sentence. Did you catch that? He goes on to finish his thought. However, they are all clearly wrong. Since a perfectly rational, good, and just God would never place people in such a condition, only a sadistic God would do so. Now, that is the prevalent view today. Prevalent. Oh, I have his name, but I won't give it to you. Someone you would probably recognize. Huh? I'm trying to keep my trouble that I'm getting in today is to a minimum. Okay, but let's just besides the obvious, the attack on the separation of Christ from God. You see how he did that? He linked Christ to who? Paul and who? Other traditional Christian writers, other traditional Christian believers. So Jesus is the same as them. He also left out the inspiration of the Bible, didn't he? Because who wrote it? God wrote it. Holy Spirit inspired writers to write. It's God's work. So he took that, and instead of saying God says, he says Jesus says, Paul says, and people say, they're all people. He also said that Christ is what? Wrong. So he attacked his omniscience. Not only did he strip him from the deity, he separated him from God. He declared him clearly wrong. Because it is beyond a reasonable doubt. It is beyond doubt when you read what Christ says that sinners are punished. Unforgiven sinners are punished severely and eternally in hell. There is no doubt. Can't argue that. So what do we have to do then if we don't like it? You can't make Jesus God, because if you do so, then you've made God sadistic. And unjust, right? This such thinking and teaching is categorized, so you know the theological term, it's categorized as subordination of divine righteousness. That's what it's called. Specifically here, I am subordinating divine righteousness to what? Subordination means make less than. I am put in an inferior position to. I am subordinating divine righteousness, which would be judgment, to what? To divine love. What did I just say happened in Genesis 15? The divine love and the divine righteousness are equal and in agreement as they go through those parts. That's what Genesis 15 is trying to say to you. Genesis 15 is a clear illustration that divine righteousness and divine mercy are interdependent. They act together. God's love and God's wrath are in agreement. Can't say that enough. There's your covenant right there. See, this agreement between the divine righteousness and the divine love is portrayed in Genesis 15 and portrayed in Matthew 26, 36 through 55. So the agreement, if you will, is between divine love and divine righteousness. And what they're agreeing to, that unlocks Gethsemane, and that unlocks Genesis 15. I'll give you a clue. Who is the agreement between divine love and divine righteousness? Christ is. He is the solution. That's what all those pieces are. They're portraying him. Okay? That Christ is the solution that reconciles God's mercy. I'm inside of time from a human perspective. Christ is the solution that reconciles God's mercy and God's holy justice. Okay. Now on to Leviticus 16, Yom Kippur and the goats. What am I trying to do? I'm trying to unravel. We spent time on the heifer. We're going to spend a little time on the goat. I'm going to try to unravel the meaning of the 3-year-old female goat from Genesis 15. So you have to have a textbook. Somebody hand out the Bibles. Make people have one. Okay? Go get a green Bible and throw it at somebody. Because you have to follow along. You cannot depend on me. Turn to Leviticus 16. We're just going to read 22 verses. Just 22. How easy is that? You cannot get this listening to me. I'll repeat it one more time. You have to read it. There are Bibles in the kitchen. There's some right here. Oh, yes, it is. It's in the bulletin. Thank you. But that's really tiny, tiny, tiny words that I can't read. Here, young lady. Here, person sitting next to her. I'm not being irreverent. Who else? Raise your hand. I can hit you from here.
Don't hit me.
Okay. Here we go. Isn't it great when it's a small class? Because I can see you all in a small class. Can't hide behind the other students. Here we go, 16:1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses. Excuse me. Now the Lord spoke to Moses. Don't pass over the word now. It's at a perfect time. Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron. Aaron's sons are dead. Why are they dead? They died on the first day of the job. God killed them. He did. He killed them, shot them, boom, dead, both of them. They barely got their uniforms on. Think McDonald's. Finally got their hat, got their little uniform, put their first hamburger on the out there, and the customer shot them both dead. Isn't God sadistic and evil? By the way, that's how that's interpreted. But you know better, don't you? You know that I'm being silly. But note that Leviticus 16 occurs after the death of the sons of Aaron. How's Aaron feeling about this? Hey, you got a new job. God gave it to you. Your job is to be the high priest. By the way, we're going to put your sons on the payroll. Hey, things are sounding good. First day, your sons are both killed. How you feeling? Aaron, just as a side note here, because I'm wandering off into the woods, aren't I? Aaron understands this. He understands what happened to his sons. He also understands what happened to his sons. Does that make sense? He knows why they were physically killed and he knows where they are. Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron when they offered profane fire before the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron your brother not to come. Oh, do you think he'd listen? Yeah, he's listening now. Tell your brother not to come at just any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat which is on the ark, lest he die. Is he going to die? If he does it any other way at any other time. Yes, he just saw his sons die. And what is that? That is the divine righteousness, isn't it? Divine righteousness is dealing with this. God is both divine love, divine mercy, and divine righteousness. And they are in agreement. I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat. So who's in this room when Aaron goes in here on this one day? God's in there. Don't come in on any other day or what? You're going to die. Why would you die? Why can you come in on this day, but you can't come in on any other day? But why this seems to be just some arbitrary thing. Is it arbitrary? No. What is so special about this day? Why this? We'll keep going. Thus Aaron shall come into the holy place with the blood of a young bull as a sin offering and of a ram as a burnt offering. He shall put on the holy linen tunic and the linen trousers on his body. What does he normally wear, by the way, except on all the other days? He shall be girded with a linen sash, and with a linen turban he shall be attired. These are holy garments. Therefore he shall wash his body in water. Normally just had to wash his hands and feet. Now he's got to wash his own body, whole body. You immediately, as soon as I say he's going to wash his whole body, you scream at me, what? Yeah, it's like baptism. It's very similar to the Jewish mikveh when we wash the bride, because the bride is what? Got to clean her. Why? Why do I have to clean the bride before I can have the ceremony? I had to hose her down. How come? She's dirty. But I got to take care of this high priest. I got to wash his whole body in water. What do you think? Come on, come on, you can do this. Water. What's in the water? Ashes of the red heifer in the water. I'm washing, and that, by the way, is how all of these things connect. You see, every time you see, you start with the ashes of the red heifer, you're going to find the ashes of the red heifer with the goat. You're going to find the ashes of the red heifer with the ram. You're going to find the ashes of the red heifer with the turtle dove and the young pigeon. You're going to find the cedar. You're going to find the hyssop. You're going to find the scarlet. It's all going to tie together every time. Now, keep reading. And he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel two kids of the goats. There's your goats. But I got two of them, and they're not female this time. As a sin offering, and one ram as a burnt offering. Now we've learned something about the goat. The goat here is a sin offering. The ram is a burnt offering. Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house. You all want... Page here, you got this figured out? Does it make any sense to you? I got something here. I say this. To say that this, Leviticus 16, is a difficult passage is akin to saying the USS Ronald Reagan is a nice boat. It doesn't quite convey the totality. Leviticus 16 is backwards Chinese calculus. Word problems. That's what we got here. Have a nice day. That's what we're doing. Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering. Note there's an order here. He's got to wash himself. He's got to put on the garments. He's got a bull. He's got a couple of goats. And he's got to get it on the right day, and he's got to get it in the right order. Because if he doesn't, what happens? Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house. He shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. That's the tent of Moses. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats. What he does is he has an urn. He sticks both his hands in. Now, it's considered good luck if the right hand got the YHVH goat. The left hand got the Azazel goat. Sometimes it didn't go that way. But he reaches in, he pulls them out. Now he's got two stickers, he puts them on both goats. Cast lots for the two goats. One lot for the Lord. Note that it's capitalized, which means it's the ineffable, YHVH, the unpronounceable name of God. One goat is for God himself. And the other lot for Azazel. Sometimes I'll say Azazel, but Azazel is probably more correct. I just have trouble saying that. So I got a goat for YHVH, who is who? God, which is a what? He's a person. And I have a goat for Azazel, who is, according to your Bible, what's it say? It doesn't say Azazel, does it, in your Bible? It says scapegoat. Yes, cross out scapegoat. Even in the other people's Bible. Reach over to your neighbor, cross it out in their Bible. Here's a Bible anywhere near you, cross it out. It isn't scapegoat, it's Azazel. And that is also a person. We'll cover that in a minute. If we get to it. Oh, almost out of time. And Aaron shall bring the goat on which the Lord's lot fell and offer it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell to be for Azazel shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it and to let it go as the Azazel into the wilderness. And Aaron shall bring the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house, and shall kill the bull as the sin offering, which is for himself. Do you get that? It's for himself. How many times you got to repeat it? Then he shall take a censer full of burning coals of fire from the altar before the Lord, with his hands full of sweet incense beaten fine. Note the beaten fine, the incense, the sweet aroma, beaten fine. Who's that? That's Christ. He's a sweet savor, and he, of course, is beaten fine. What's the point of beaten fine? It's an impurity search, right? And bring it inside the veil. And he shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the testimony, lest he die. Better bring this incense in here, and better make sure lots of incense, because if I don't, what happens? Boom, lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack. Okay? Gonna die. Is God cruel? Is what God doing here cruel? Making him hop through all these hoops, do all, put on the garment, take off the garment, wash yourself, bring a bull, get a couple of goats, walk in here, have the right incense. If you don't do it right, don't do it in the correct order. You do anything wrong, what happens? You die. Now the modern people that read this, especially the ones that don't care about the Bible or theological thought in any way, they read this and they see God as what? Capricious. Childish. They see him as they see a God of I don't know how to put it correctly. I can't grab the word, but they see a God, as this guy pointed out, as sadism, as somebody who is just deliberately putting things in front of people in order to get them to die, and then he casts them into hell forever. That's their view of God. They don't understand. Why do you die in Scripture if you do something wrong? And you're in the priesthood. Do you know? Do I cover it? Let's see if I do. Hang on. Sometimes I forget. I got it. Yes, you have violated a profound spiritual truth. Which one? Yes, you have. You have rejected Jesus Christ. If you don't come into the holy place with the censer and the right clothes on, you have rejected Jesus Christ. If you are Nadab and Abihu and you bring the wrong fire, I mean, who is the fire? Christ is the fire. That fire that's on that altar is provided by God. You go get somebody else's fire and put it on that altar. What have you just done? You've said that any fire is good. Any fire isn't good. If you don't have the right fire when you're standing in front of the throne, what happens to you? You're cast into permanent outer darkness, weeping, gnashing teeth, right? That's what's being typified here. So bring the right smoke. When you go in front of the judgment seat, if you want to survive that, what must you do? Genesis 15. What does Christ say you do? Take me. You better take me. If you don't take me and you're in front of the holy throne of God, what will happen? You will die. What kind of death? What's the definition of death? Total. It's the second death. It is severe and eternal lake of fire. Take me. Do you think Aaron knew that? Yeah. Because of Nadab and Abihu. Okay. You don't know that, you die. That's right. You're absolutely right. Take Christ. If you go in front of God, and it'll be Christ on the throne, all judgment is given to the Son. I think that's John 5:37. Check me out. I usually don't memorize things well. But you go in front of the judgment seat without Christ, you will die. Okay? Let's keep reading. He shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat on the east. And before the mercy seat, he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger 7 times. Not 8 times, not 6 times, 7 times. Then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, bring its blood inside the veil, do with that blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat before the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. So I got a whole bunch of blood in there now. The blood all over the mercy seat. What's the mercy seat? It's the lid, if you will, that is on top of the Ark of the Covenant that has the cherubim shape on it. And inside that lid is what? Manuscript of Moses, the manna, the budded rod, the Ten Commandments on its stone tablets. So he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel and because of their transgressions for all their sins. And so he shall do for the tabernacle of meeting, which remains among them in the midst of their uncleanness. There shall be no man in the tabernacle of meeting when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household. And for all the assembly of Israel, and he shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it, and shall take some of the blood of the bull and some of the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altar all around. He's got a big job here, an all-day sucker, doesn't he? He's running around all over the place spreading goat and bull blood. Then he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger 7 times, cleanse it and consecrate it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel. And when he has made an end of the atoning for the holy place, the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, he shall bring the live goat. Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. What's the obvious question there? Who gets that job and why is he suitable? And the goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities to an uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat in the wilderness. Okay. Leviticus 16, as I said, is a calculus problem in backwards Chinese, and to make matters worse, scholars don't agree on the Christology. They don't agree on the portrait of Christ that is depicted here in Leviticus 16, and the rabbinical scholars, the Jews, don't even agree on how this should be done. Every time you read a book, you'll find a different idea. And to prepare for this morning, I read Connor, Scott, Chumney, Edersheim, Lindsay, and Kurtz, because those are the ones that I have, and I thought that's going to do it. And even though I had done this before, I was amazed. I told Lori this morning, or somebody yesterday, I can't remember. I couldn't find anybody that agreed with me. And I wanted someone to agree with me, anyone, and it wasn't easy to find them. I ended up with Kurtz, and I should have gone there first. He's kind of one of my heroes, and I did find them. I am going to present a position that agrees with Kurtz and Barr and Studel and Paulus and Wiener and Thorluck. And all of those guys have one thing in common. They're all dead German Jews, all Christian. And Kurtz wrote his definitive work in 1863, and that passes my requirement that the commentator be long dead. And Kurtz and Edersheim mostly agree, for those of you who care about things like that. But I'm putting that in there mostly for the people who get this on CD so they can track me down. But again, notice how this begins, Leviticus 16. It's a reference back to the deaths of Nadab and Abihu. In other words, physical death can occur. We covered that a little bit. I got out of sequence, but let me finish it off. Be careful, he's saying, when you come before me. Do this, perform this ceremony perfectly. Make no mistake. The Shekinah glory is in the Holy of Holies. God is there. You can see Him. He is in the form of a cloud and light. It must be understood what's at stake here. When you do something that pollutes the doctrine of the salvation by Christ alone, then you will die in front of the nation of Israel. Why does he do that? Because he's protecting all those people who are what? The only nation in the world at the time that have any idea how salvation works. And they're the ones that are going to be responsible for teaching others. And he cannot let them think that you can pollute the doctrine of salvation by Christ's blood, faith, belief alone. You can't pollute that. If you do, I've got no choice but to what? Blow you up. Because I got all them watching you. We have a similar thing in church. If you walked into a Sunday school class of kids here, first we'd have to have kids. But let's assume, hypothetically, we do. And you are the Sunday school teacher and you walk in and say universalism, there are a bunch of different ways you can be saved. What would I do? What would the elders do to you here? Yes, we would shoot you. Okay, I'm kidding. But we would cast you, you would not be allowed ever. I wouldn't know what to do with somebody that would do that. That is polluting the doctrine of salvation by Christ alone. If you do that, Nadab and Abihu or Aaron, you make any mistake here, you are going to hurt the people that are watching you. I can't let you do it. If you do it, you did it willfully, I got to blow you up, get a new priest. If I ever stand up here and say, you know, I've reconsidered, there's a couple other ways you might be saved, what should you do? Rise up and get rid of me. Or what will happen? Someone will die, and it won't be physical death. God doesn't worry about physical death. It's the second death. It's God's definition. Atonement. This is atonement. What does atonement mean? It means to satisfy the legal penalty. Pay the debt, pay the price. Expiation, that's a term you have to learn. Expiation. It's not easy to spell it, but it is a technical or a theological term. The price has got to be paid. Now, how do I pay it? Well, I pay it with all of this stuff that we've been doing. I pay it here in 16. All of these things are pictures of Christ. Leviticus 16 outlines for us why it has to be paid, how it has to be paid, and who's going to pay it, and no one else can pay it. No one else can do it except this way, and this way is a portrait. And having a functional understanding of Leviticus 16 is going to unlock the mysteries of the crucifixion, and you won't be fooled by silly movies anymore. And I'm in trouble for that. Because we love those silly movies. And look, you're not going to get perfect theology in a movie. You're not. I know. But you can want it. And you can point out what's right and what's wrong to your kids and your grandchildren. See, the first thing I would be doing if I was in one of them silly movies, which I don't go to because I can't stand them, but if I would, I'd be yelling out answers, wouldn't I? How long would they let me stay in the auditorium when I would be saying, that didn't happen. That's wrong. Read Leviticus. How about Genesis 50? How long would I stay in there? Yeah, they would get rid of me. I would be ruining it for the others, wouldn't I? Which is my great ministry and gift. Having a functional understanding of Leviticus 16 will unlock the mysteries of the crucifixion for you, eliminate doctrinal errors and misconceptions. So it's so important. Okay, here we go. Gonna fight fast because we're really done. I've only got 4 more pages. We can do those in an hour. Okay, we're going to try to establish the order. First, these kinds of questions. Why this day? I asked that earlier. It's the 10th day of the 7th month of the Hebrew religious calendar. Why did God establish this day? What else happened on this day? Something happened on this day. What else? And there's lots of speculation. What's the number one speculation that happened on this day? He picked the 10th day of the 7th month. By the way, Adam was born on the first day of the 7th month. But something happened on the 10th day of the 7th month at some point before they left the garden, probably, or immediately after. What happened on the 10th day of the 7th month? Okay, next, why two goats? And by the way, I got two goats here. One dies, one lives. I have two birds. In Leviticus 14, when I have the ritual for the cleansing of the healed leper, right? And what happens to one of them birds? It dies, the other lives. I have a relationship now between goats and birds. Yay! Figure out birds, figure out goats. Figure out goats, figure out birds. How easy can it be? Chinese arithmetic. And hopefully you'll remember that the ashes of the red heifer, the cedar, the scarlet, the hyssop, they connect to all of these things. Okay? Look therefore for the ashes of the red heifer. And as I pointed out, that's when Aaron has to bathe or wash himself. Now, Numbers 29, 7 through 11 even adds more information, because not only did all this occur on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, but also he had to do the ordinary morning and evening sacrifices on top of this. That's 15 more animals to kill. So, let's just look at what he's got. He's got to do the morning sacrifice first. Then he's got to kill the bull. Okay? He's got to kill the bull. Why? That's for him. Got to kill the bull for himself and his household and the priesthood. Okay? Why does he have to kill a bull and make atonement, expiation for himself? Why has he got to do that for himself? Because why? He's dirty. His household is dirty and the entire priesthood is dirty. I can't get that through your heads enough. Number one con game in the church today is that the priesthood is not dirty. Priesthood is filthy dirty. Says so Leviticus 16. Now, do we have a priesthood like they've got today? No, we don't. What we have is a pastorate. There are those who dress just like the Hebrew priests, and they think they're Hebrew priests, but they're not. They're Gentiles pretending to be Hebrew priests. They haven't read their Leviticus. Hey, priesthood is filthy dirty. Aaron is dirty. He's really dirty. We got to hit him with the ashes of the red heifer. That's sandblasting. Think of it that way. Okay? And a very important truth is that. And the holy place had to be cleansed. How come I gotta have this smoke? All these things. The holy place is dirty. Why is the holy place dirty? Did you catch that when we read by? Holy place is dirty because it's in the middle of something. What's it in the middle of? People. The nation of Israel is filthy dirty, and the Holy of Holies and the holy place and the tent of Moses, the tabernacle, that's also filthy because why? I got people in it. Think cockroaches. I got to smoke them out. All of this had to be cleansed because it was horribly unclean. This, the building, the tent, the people, the altar, everything about it is filthy dirty. Who so says? God so says. Aaron had special white garments for this day. These are special. Can you think of anybody that wears special white garments? Never mind. I have a sacrifice for the people. I got to kill a goat. I got to draw lots. I have YHVH. I have Azazel, and they are people. This is Satan. I have to draw a goat for Satan. Satan gets a goat, and God gets a goat. Goat for Satan, goat for God. The goat for Satan gets to live. Goat for God gets killed. Which one's the lucky goat? What would the goat choose? Yeah, think it that way. Change your perspective. I have the releasing of the second goat. I have the evening sacrifices and I have all these other animals and they all have to be without blemish. On that second goat, I got a scarlet cord tied around his head. By the way, the Jews began to do innovative things. They didn't like the way this came out, so they decided what would they do. They wouldn't let the goat live. What did they decide to do? They decided to push it over a cliff and it died. Then they had a guy people with flags signaled that the goat went over the cliff. That did not occur until after the Septuagint was written. So that it went 1,000 years or better without that innovation in it. So you got to weed all that stuff out. Okay, the keys to all of this is the cloud, the Shekinah glory, a picture of Christ is in the building. That would be like if you go through that door over there, you run into the Shekinah glory. Okay, think of it that way. When I draw these lots, I put all the sins of Israel on the first goat. I wish I had a goat. Who could I use? I need somebody. I always pick Eric. Come here, Eric. I'm going to show you how it's really done. You have not seen this done. This is the laying on of hands. And what I'm doing as the priest is come up here where they can see you. I am transferring the sins of Israel to the goat. Say, bah.
Bah.
Okay. Now this is how it's done. You see it done. I know you do. But this is how I transfer sin. As hard as I physically can. Push down. Now, I didn't push on his head, but they push on the head as hard as they can. You can sit down now. Now, this is how I get more dividend check money. I'm transferring the sins of the nation of Israel into this goat. Tremendous pressure put down on it. Okay? Then the second goat is alive. And he is released. Now, every theologian that I named agreed that the expiation of the sins, the penalty, the removal of the sins, is the first goat. Solve that. There is no more sin in the nation of Israel. So why am I putting sin on the second goat? I got no more sin. If I say that I didn't get rid of the sin on the first goat, I got big problems because the goat's a picture of Christ. All of those issues. I got to put blood on the mercy seat. Why do I have to put blood on the mercy seat? I got to go in there with a cloud of incense. Why do I go in there with a cloud of incense? Because I have to hide in it. The cloud covers me. So now you know the incense is Christ hiding you from what? Yeah, hiding you from getting blown out of there. He used to tie a rope around the foot of the high priest in case he made a mistake. And they haul him back out. That cloud, you go in there with the wrong incense, you're not hiding very good. You go in there without any blood on the mercy seat, that law comes right up through that Ark of the Covenant and does what? Kills you. That's right. Now think about this. Atonement for the holy sanctuary, atonement for the tabernacle, atonement for the altar, atonement for himself, atonement for his family, atonement for the priests, atonement for the people. What we just learned. Do it every day, every evening. Do it on this day like crazy. What we just learned. We just learned that we're very, very dirty people in the eyes of God. You are amazingly dirty. Off the chart, peg the needle dirty. You have no chance of cleaning yourself. No chance. You got to have sandblasting. And it's got to be God. He's got to be the sand and he's got to be the blaster. You can't even come into his sight unless he's hiding you in fog. That's him. You can't go near that mercy seat unless it's covered with blood. That's him. Do not be one thing proud of yourself. Do not think that you can solve this. If you do, you will what? Die. That's his lesson. We'll finish it off next week, we hope. Let's rise and be dismissed.